The founders forgot that we had medical liberty.
We seem to be losing by taking the side of the middle. And we seem to constantly be losing.
I think Trump has made some kind of arrangements with Russia.
This person has made the allegations that they were a man.
If there's content that's borderline, that's content that we basically will not.
There is no second best. There is no second best crypto asset.
Let's talk about science.
I respect you and I have a great deal of appreciation to you, JF, because in a time when everybody was attacking me, when Sargon doxed me and smeared me, you were the only one who gave me a platform, and you were very kind in helping me put the truth out there.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to JFG Tonight. Sorry for the background. I'm still working on it. But for a couple of days or perhaps weeks, I don't know, the time it takes for me to take it, you'll have to endure blue backgrounds because I have to build a lot of blocks to fill the space with beautiful stained wood, and I'm taking my time to do the artistry correctly. Cat's Dead says, Jeff, the edit you posted on your Twitter was hilarious, seeing you make all of those crazy faces. Yes, I love this edit because it's the first time I use Grok Imagine I started from a picture of me from an old show, and I said to Grok Imagine, can you do something funny with it? And without even me prompting it specifically for this, Grok decided to give me a video of myself eating wood, because Grok noticed that I had logs, wooden logs in the back of my setup, and I just take a piece of wood and I look at this. I will play it right here. It was just to celebrate my successful prediction from yesterday. Look at this. I love this. Sell my gold to buy Bitcoin or sell Bitcoin to buy gold? Well, I think gold has had a good run in the last few weeks, but it has to stop there. So there will be a time at which in which this peak is attained and capital will move back into Bitcoin and other things. So I wouldn't bet on gold right now. I think gold, if you bet on gold 6 months ago, you did a brilliant move. But I wouldn't push my luck too much on this stuff. Incredible. I love doing trailer edits. Sometimes I love it so much that I do it for no reason at all. Like, I'm not trying to acquire more audience. I don't think these edits are watched by any other people than the people who already know me. But I just love it. I love trailers. I love the art of the ad was something in society that we've lost. The ad is now an annoying thing. But the ad used to be an opportunity for art, and it became its own art form. Try hard, says JF. It's my birthday. I'm attention whore years old day. Well, congratulations, try hard, for trying hard up to your current age. Enjoy the attention. People in the regular chat can celebrate it with you. Good job, try hard. Marby Dog on YouTube. I'm watching both the YouTube and the Rumble chat. Marby Dog says, Jeff, I am YouTube watching you. I'm usually watching on Rumble. Subscribed. Yeah, I know that it sucks that we are divided in two communities. But I'm doing this during the time where I'm applying for monetization. We'll see how YouTube does. We'll see if people enjoy the platform. We'll see if YouTube is open to monetization. If these conditions are met and if I feel free enough to do my art on YouTube, I might come back to YouTube. But we're far from there. Still, I'm still attached to Rumble because that's where I have the most freedom to speak. And I don't have anything much extreme to say. But it's very important that what I do have to say, it's very important that I don't even feel that it's borderline. I need space. This is something that is so misunderstood, and it connects to our parenting subject of today, space. Leave space for learning. I couldn't find the video, but there was this professor of psychology, beautiful video that I retweeted about 2 months ago. And he says the following, and I believe that's completely correct. There is not much coming from the study of psychology. The field of developmental psychology is a big scam. There, I'm not quoting exactly his words, but I'm paraphrasing and I'm adding my own views of this. The field of developmental psychology is largely unreliable studies, concepts that are developed on, you know, for the purpose of theoretical categorizing, but not proven by a true hard science. So developmental psychology sucks by many standards, but there is one thing that I think is one of the most repeatable results and most confident results we can be, the most confident we can be in any result coming from developmental psychology, and it is something that people don't want to hear. It is the fact that your children will largely converge toward an already established program, and there is barely anything you can do about it. And we see this in the domains that are covered by IQ. Certainly, you know, IQ is like a destination. You don't get to change the IQ of your children. Your children are growing into adults. They have a target IQ, and they're headed there. And all you can do during their development is you can make them take the steps a little faster. So it's very easy to make a study in which I take a 5-year-old, I overtrain him, and then I take another bunch of 5-year-old and I don't train them. And it's very easy to show in a scientific study, oh, look, my training worked. They do better on IQ tests. But there's a big illusion coming from this kind of study. Because when we get down to the dirty mechanics of it, the fact is we just speeded up the development of these children. And the other group, we didn't speed up their development, but they're all headed toward the same average IQ. So what this professor of psychology was saying is, other than grave stuff, other than complete neglect and that kind of stuff, largely your children are converging toward their determined state. About 90% of what they will be as adults is pre-programmed, and you're just there to enjoy the show. And, you know, the professor of psychology was framing it as a positive thing. The great thing is that you can now sit back and just address needs and enjoy the show. Get the popcorn out and just watch. Just watch how it's inevitable. It's inevitable that your children will speak well because you speak well. It's inevitable that they will seek social relationship because it's programmed in their genes over millions of years. It's inevitable that they will seek satisfaction, growth, and realization of their own will in the world. Because we come from cavemen, and they had to work for their food, and there is something in the brain that has just been inserted by genetics, and it's like, don't let yourself die, go get some food. The good news, and this appears especially at the third year and fourth year of parenting, because those are years where you can finally step back. We have already our two guides for the first year parenting and the second year parenting. Those guides were focused on the first year, of course, all needs, all checking of the child, his health, food, nutrition, skin-to-skin contact, as they call it in hospital. I find the fact that it's labeled that way completely ridiculous, but attachment. And eventually we worked, especially in the second year parenting, postural development, motor development, locomotor challenges, standing, how to develop their posture a little quicker, how to meet the milestones of them having a straight back and, you know, standing with structure and eventually learning to walk a little faster. Those are the things you can do. And there's a couple of toys that I've suggested in those guides. You should go back. If you're in the first or second year parenting, go back to these guides. Now we're going to enter the third year parenting. Technically, the third year would be when they are two, 3 years old. And the fourth year would be when they are 3 to 4 years old. And the good news there is you will start to gain from the investments that you've done in the early years. You will start to gain in the independence of your children, and it will be beautiful to see. Let's get into it. Kat's dad says, Jeff, are you more okay with being more respected in science for TRP after you pass? It seems that most people don't get credit until they are long gone. Well, I've said it for a long time. TRP is this kind of big idea that will not be fully acknowledged in my lifetime. And I said when I wrote the book and published it, it's going to take 20 years for general adherence, maybe in the halls of academia, and maybe 40 years and 60 years for full public recognition and full agreement by basically everyone. This guy was right. So that, yes, I do live well with this. I like that I have found a truth of that depth. Because let me tell you, this this doesn't happen often. It doesn't happen often, especially in modern science, where an idea is so big that it will be absolutely rejected at the moment that it is presented. And in fact, it got more than rejected in a way. It got ignored and spit on. Like, instead of having actual conversations with scientists about the contents of my book, they sent me their whole army of smearers and JF is evil and JF is a killer. It's like, whoa, you guys have unleashed, you guys have cracked out the big bottle. Marby Dog says, I could not agree more, JF. Jill Biden has a PhD in early childhood development, so you know it is worthless, based in magical thinking. Oh, yeah. Surgeon Steele says, IQ is now an illusion. What the fuck? No, it's not an illusion. It's an illusion if you boost it at a certain age that is not yet crystallized. So when you compare 5 years old to 5 years old and you find one has a higher IQ than the other, it almost means nothing about the IQ that they will reach at 18 years old. I'm not saying IQ is bullshit as a whole. I'm saying be careful. Because there's a way you can pack into the data your kind of preferences about the world. Now you're going to do a little intervention. You're going to show, oh, these 5 years old are more intelligent than these 5 years old. But you haven't asked yourself this. Is it good to develop faster? Is it always good to develop faster? Now, I get it. Every parent wants to see their kids in advance on everything. So they feel safe about it. I don't challenge that you'll feel safe. It's like, oh, yeah, my children are 1 year in advance on this, 2 years in advance on that. But the matter that you feel safe about it and you feel satisfied about it is a whole different question from the question, will their lives be better? Because if all you do is take these children and give them a little boost, which they lose down the line, to converge toward their crystallized IQ of adulthood, which is genetically coded, no doubt. That is one of the biggest certainty of the science of psychology, that the destination of IQ is crystallized IQ in adult age, and it's largely down to 5 IQ points plus or minus. It's largely genetically programmed. Laura L says, Jeff, am I tripping or a long time ago you had a baby while live streaming? I regularly do. I don't ever bring my babies on the camera, if that's what you're asking. But throughout my live streaming career, I have inseminated women. In fact, my latest child is born a month ago. So yes, I constantly have babies while streaming. And in fact, since I am liberated from this couple, I am now single, and there is an offer up for insemination. So if you want to be my next partner for reproduction, you can send me an email. I am available for action. Sean Tenman says, are any vaccines good for newborns at this point? Won't doctors try to convince you your child will almost 100% chance of dying without them? Yes, so that's a very tough question, because there are places where literally they will call CPS on you for choosing not to vaccinate. Let me tell you, my children are completely unvaccinated children, and they are thriving. I see all of the children that are vaccinated, and they end up they end up suffering from all sorts of things, and I'm like, is it possible that it's ultimately due to vaccines? And I think maybe. My approach, of course, I have the privilege of being in a part of the country that will respect your parental rights on decision making, on medical decision making. So I'm lucky. Do what you have to do based on your circumstance and your, you know, there are states in the US where you will get in trouble for choosing not to vaccinate. So follow your conscience to the best possible, but I know it's not always possible to fight the system, and you shouldn't take a fight against the system unless you want it, unless you're ready to pay the price of it, because more and more we see in liberal states an attack on parents that choose not to vaccinate. And yet we have these studies that show unvaccinated homeschooled children are doing fucking amazing on so many measures: better schooling, better politeness, better emotional stability in adulthood, less neurodevelopmental problems, less otitis, less even intestinal problems. I have come to believe that there is something we haven't caught properly in the effect of vaccines on the whole of society. And the reason we haven't caught it properly is we have destroyed the control group. Right now, if you look at all of the kids that are unvaccinated in the US or in Canada, it's a very small subset of people, and they are very weird. They come from parents that are very weird. They come from families that are very conservative or very doubting of the state or very doubting of modernity. And it's like, it's the whole Trump comment about the Amish. It's like, yeah, there's something good about the Amish lifestyle, because there's all sorts of things they don't suffer from. Now, is it because the Amish have good genes? Is it because the Amish don't vaccinate? Is it because they don't go see the doctor? Is it because they suffer in secret from the disease, but they never get to diagnose it? All of these questions are valid. But it is absolutely unacceptable that in the state of modern parenting, the state decides for you, decides that you're going to take that risk rather than that risk. Because there are risks everywhere. There are risks not to vaccinate. I have personally concluded, and the COVID thing was kind of reinforcing of this, but I had developed since the H1N1 days of, I believe that was maybe 2009, if I remember correctly. Since the 2000s, I have noticed an absolute insanity into society when it comes to compelling of medical decision making. And I have felt since then, and this got strongly reinforced in the COVID crisis, but I have felt since then that something was wrong, that we are pursuing medical evidence in the domain of vaccines in the same way we are in the domain of climate change and all of these leftists, you know, these studies that are designed to conclude something. And I'm afraid that if vaccines were dangerous, and I believe some of them are, that there would be no way to know. There would be no way to know. So my philosophy has been, look, society can do whatever they want. Other parents can do whatever they want. I do not judge people for vaccinating themselves. But prudence in the face of poor science is the optimal choice in my view. From everything I've gathered in my life, they are not ready to admit there's just too much money. The system is built so that you're kind of forced. And the suggestions of these vaccine schedules are all built with the assumption that you're doing something wrong if you don't do this. But there is a wisdom in, there is wisdom hidden in concepts like don't fix it if it's not broken. Don't fix it if it's not broken. That is a rule of engineering, of biology and life. And I believe that the vaccine proponents have completely missed that. Don't fix it if it's not broken. Doubting Thomas says, JF, what do you think about the theories of the rise of allergies? Allegedly, the Amish are exposed to cows. Underexposure as an explanation for modern allergies and modern immune problems, very plausible to me. I don't have a strong opinion, but underexposure to actual natural stimuli and overexposure to artificial stimuli. So we're injecting people with industrial vaccines produced in conditions that are very hard to control, because let's not forget, the production of a vaccine is a form of farming. You are farming the virus, you are then deactivating the virus, you are making decisions about which virus are we going to farm, in what kind of medium are we going to farm it. These viruses have their own evolutionary history in the lab. They evolve into different things in the lab. They get mutations in the lab. And then we inject this on the assumption that this will protect your child against something that is now completely disconnected from the lab environment, the natural viruses out there with their own evolutionary histories. And we find ourselves in, there are certain vaccine campaigns in Africa that have led to more polio than the polio that we've eradicated. We're now giving polio to people more than we are stopping it from happening. So I didn't want this show to be about vaccines. I'll move on to the parenting strategy for third and fourth year. But the philosophy with my philosophy with vaccines is the same as much of the rest, which is appreciate the force of nature. Appreciate. There was this midwife, brilliant midwife, unfortunately had to leave Canada. And I've always suspected that that basically she was probably trying to flee exactly the kind of things I had to flee. Persecution of her family. But that I've never known because I didn't get to ask her. But there was this midwife, very wise woman, who told me, because we were talking about induction, after the pregnancy, you know, for birth, causing the labor by injecting a chemical that signals to the body of the woman, start labor. And in these days, they almost induce every woman. And this midwife told me something that that contains so much wisdom. She said, "Do you see any woman walking around with a 2-year-old in their belly?" And I said, "No." And she said, "You know why? There's no woman walking around with 2-year-old in their belly. It's because labor will always start at some point." And I was like, mind blown. Wow, this is powerful. So yeah, she's right. You won't even get a 10-month-old baby in your belly, because labor will always start within the due date or within up to 2 weeks or maximum 3 weeks after. All babies will all be born. And yet we are inducing women at a point that nature hasn't quite decided that the baby was ready, and we're doing it artificially. And yet we know that nature would have come to do it itself at the right time. Remind yourself of this when you parent your children. Development isn't a clocked, scheduled thing. It is scheduled, but it's not scheduled by time. See, one of the big modern mistakes of humanity is to believe that time is the unit of scheduling. Nature works with time, but it works on bases that are even more solid than time. When the genetic programs of development develop themselves, they don't ask themselves, "Is my child 1 year old? Well, now it's time to develop this. Is he 2 year old? Now it's time to develop this." It's a stack of genetic recipes that deploy themselves in order. And they wait for the last step to be ready, and then they jump on the next step. That's how nature works. There's no clock in your child. There's no place in your child's body where it's written his age or his date of birth. Nature has its own mechanism to say, it's time for this, it's time for that. And this is not the linear measurement of time. All of this to say, follow the midwife strategy in your life. Don't ask yourself, is the exact milestone met at what Google recommends or what Stanford University recommends? But ask yourself, is there any way this won't develop? Is there any way the baby will never get out of my belly? No, it's going to get out. Is there any way my baby will never learn to speak? No, he's going to learn it at some point. Appreciate the speed of nature rather than the speed of time. Doubting Thomas says, "Jeff, well, what about the larger former mortality rate of children and mothers at childbirth?" Here's the thing. I don't believe that we have properly isolated what causes this improvement. Because if you ask me what led to high number of deaths of women and children, first, I will tell you there is a lot of estimation being done about this. And just like there is this false conception that women were unhappy in marriage 100 years ago, there are lots of false conceptions about the idea that they kept dying all the time because of childbirth. I seriously doubt this. Secondly, even if there was still, after a proper estimate, even if there were still a difference between today and then, I would point to the fact that we have so much better nutrition. Nothing indicates that it's doctors and hospitals saving people. Nothing indicates that it's vaccines protecting women or protecting children. It's very possible that there is something in modernity that is very good, and it's probably something along the lines of nutrition and the fact that, yeah, you know, 100 years ago, try to get your zinc, your proper zinc quantities throughout the year. It's like, yeah, if you're a good farmer with pigs and cows, you're going to get there. But if you're at the bottom of society, you're impoverished, you are maybe homeless, you are maybe, I don't know, you're living a world at the bottom of society, you're not getting your zinc nutrition needs. You're not getting your vitamin C. You're not getting this and that. So no surprise that bacteria had had an edge on us then. I mean, just think about mangoes. You can go to the grocery store wherever you are in North America right now. You can go to the grocery store and get a beautiful ripe mango. Our grandparents couldn't get a mango. And I'm not saying that mangoes are super nutrients, but just think about the list of things you can get that if your grandparent was impoverished and isolated and perhaps not having a farm, or maybe the farm didn't produce that year, they couldn't get that. There was no way they could get a mango. So we have access to so much more, and yet we have also, parallel to the improvements in our lives, we have a system of parasitism that has shown up to take credit for the improvement unfairly. I'm thinking the education system. I'm thinking the medical system. They came in and they kind of look like they may cause our modern well-being. But I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure about that. And I think there's definitely a proportion of our modern well-being that is not attributable at all to these things. That is my position. You know, prove me wrong. Make the study. Make the freaking study. But we never get these studies that will test, hey, is our current system built on assumptions rather than science? I can guarantee to you that it is. Because when you see the changes in the medical practice between 100 years ago to today, look at 20 years ago. There's been all sorts of things that have been veered over their head. The way we diagnose autism, the way we over-diagnose autism, the way we assume that pediatrician care is default rather than exceptional, the way we assume that vaccines are like, it's a default. If you don't do it, you're neglecting your child. All of these things are modern creations, not of 50 years ago, of 20 years ago, of 10 years ago. Now, you're not going to tell me that 10 years ago there was a massive progress in science that forced this change. This change didn't come from facts. It came from financial pressures, healthcare management, governmental impeding on individual rights. That's how it came. It's a bunch of people who are paid to do these jobs who have argued that we should force people to be their customers. That is the development of modern medicine and modern public school. It's a cartel. It's a monopoly. I'm not saying all of medicine is bad. I am myself. I've worked in the medical sector and I've studied as a PhD in the Faculty of Medicine. I believe that medicine is a great science that can be helpful if it respects people's will. I believe it becomes absolute horror when it imposes itself socially and through pressure and through intimidation and through, if you don't do that, I'm calling CPS. Because there was a time, even in my life, I've seen that time where we were training young doctors and we were telling them, you know what? Don't threaten parents to call CPS. Because they will just record, this doctor is unreliable, I'm never coming back here. If you want to influence society in the positive direction in a voluntary way, make your argument. Give the parents information, but give them the final say. Don't go after each of them. But what happened recently, I would say, this happened within the last 20 years. There has been new laws in place because the CPS laws became more and more aggressive. And they started imposing fines on health professionals, saying if you don't report anything that could be worrying, we will fine you $5,000, $10,000, $15,000. And this has created a fear in practicing doctors that they have to report anything. So these days, in a liberal state, you get to your hospital because your child has been accidentally hurt. You get a CPS call for sure. They will come and they will try to determine, and they will force entry into your home to see if that injury could have been caused willfully or if it came from some sort of abuse. Or that is the state of medicine these days. And it's so contrary to the liberal philosophy that guided social work even back in the 90s, back in times where I was alive, where I remember there was this conception that, hey, even in the way they were teaching social workers in psychology and sociology department, they were telling the social worker, be an ally of the person you're intervening with. Be their ally rather than be their problem. But we've totally forgotten this. And part of it is just due to poor legalization, poor statutes, too aggressive, that compel social workers and professionals to do all sorts of things, like to always take the more precautious route. But the more precautious route is also an invasion of your rights, as it turns out. So we've gone through first-year parenting, second-year parenting. We have built the locomotor and motor development of the child, postural control. He's now a solid child standing on their legs. Typically, in the third year, they will already be walking. And we have also passed the era of formula and breastfeeding, although it's possible that formula will extend into the third year as a partial replacement. Because what will happen with your child once you move into the third year and they are 2 years old now, 2 year and 2 months, 2 year and 6 months, 2 year and 8 months. As you got rid of the formula in their diet, there might be some things that they don't yet want to eat. And I say, do not be alarmed by this. There are children, they will not get to meat eating late, third year, fourth year. So therefore, there will be something that lacks, there will be some nutrient lacks. And until they get adjusted to this, keep giving formula on demand. They will know if they're lacking proteins. And then formula is just a wonderful fix because it basically has everything. Because formula is designed for babies that eat only this, formula has basically everything they need. And so as you get them introduced to more and more food, and you can Google it, you know, food for 3 years old, you can go buttered broccolis, you can go ground beef, you can go sausages. Let me tell you, if your children have difficulty eating beef, let me give you a trick. Eel. Sushi restaurant eel. Now, it's a little overpriced. That's a little overpriced. But babies and growing children love eel because it's very fat, it's very buttery, and it's a good fat. It's a fat that comes from a fish. Lots of unsaturated fat. I go to the sushi restaurant. I order 6-8 nigiri. So that's just the rice tube with the eel on top, and just the eel. They love this. So there are different ways you can wean off from a formula and head toward protein food, even if they don't like pork, even if they don't like beef yet. Of course, they will like cereals, they will like bread, they will like fruits. You're going to have to work to get them to eat vegetables from the start, but complete with butter. You know, carrots do suck, and broccoli does suck if you just make them steamed. But add a little butter, pan them correctly, and carrots can become delicious, and broccoli can become delicious. So apples, strawberries, grapes, Those are all the kind of fruits they will like. By the way, children will also love avocado. If there's no allergy in your family, avocado is a very special vegetable that that is very buttery, so children like it. You can just cut slices of avocado, salt and pepper. They will love pasta. In the year, when they are 2 years old and 3 years old, your children will have arbitrary food preferences. They will like pasta, but not the sauce. They will like beef if it's ground, but not with brown sauce. They will reject certain forms of sauces and certain forms of things that would be assumed in an adult meal. And that's why children meals are always look visually more simple. You know, children don't like a mix of 10 different ingredients. So that's fine. You just complete whatever they lack in a given meal, you complete with the other meal. If you felt like their pasta meal didn't have sauce and therefore it was missing a vegetable element, well, we eat vegetables later in the afternoon or as standalone vegetables. And yes, ketchup, says New Guy Prime. Of course, children love ketchup. One good way to habituate them to proteins, if they're not yet into eating, you know, chicken, fully prepared chicken, nuggets of chicken, fries, of course, children will love this. And as far as liquids go, full access to water, they will start drinking milk. Milk is so complete. It's like it's the follow-up to formula. It's not as complete as formula. But if they eat other things and then they drink milk, they're going to be very happy and very satisfied. Eggs are also a very good way to complement the protein diet of your children at that age. Scrambled eggs or eggs that you scramble and then you cut them in squares so they can pick one square at a time and eat them like a chip a little bit. This will all be good. As far as play goes and motor development, it's starting at this age to be very interesting because the kids don't need much supervision and you can give them a couple of things that they will like. The fort building. I love this toy. It's just balls and bars, and you can build any sort of fort with it. A two-year-old will not be able to build on their own, but they will have fun if you can build it for them. They will have fun hiding in this. And you cover this house with a cover, with just a drape of some kind. They will love hiding in this. They will love playing in this. You can bring fake kitchen items and plastic. They will love acting out like it's their house. And I would say at around four or more, they will become able to even build it themselves. So that's because the clicking of these bars with the ball does demand some force that a two-year-old generally will not be able to deploy. But at four-year-old, they will become even able to construct and build their own structure. Crazy Forts is the name of it. Sour Notes was asking. Crazy Forts. And I bought a couple of boxes because the basic box of Crazy Fort allows you to build a small house. I bought three of them so you can build a big structure with tunnels and all. So I really like this toy. I think it kind of has this Minecraft taste to it where you can build anything. You can let your mind be create what you need. Of course, one of the entertainment that becomes interesting once the kids are able to walk is this kind of park. You will see them everywhere. I am sure you have a park like this within 30 minutes of driving wherever you live. These parks are extremely well built because they have degrees. Like your two-year-old will not escalate this, but your two-year-old will like to go in the smaller part of this section here, and we love to slide through the smaller slide. And it's free time. As a parent, you bring your children there, you can sit, you can just enjoy. They will slowly learn. At first, they will try to just interact with their hands with the slide. Eventually, they will understand it's a slide. I can escalate. I can go and do a cycle of sliding and then upping and sliding and upping. And these parks are good from 2 years old, where you watch them very close, up to 7, 8 years old easily, because there are more challenges as you start exploring these or these. Those are for older children, where they will require eye to feet coordination to escalate something. Sean Stedman says, I remember building a huge box fort with my sister in our playroom with cardboard boxes filled with all kinds of stuff, mostly toys and Christmas decoration boxes. My parents didn't like it, I think. Kids Dead says, when you hear JF talk about being a father, it's hard to believe that anyone would find the slander about him to be credible. Oh yeah, well, that's why I'm targeted. I'm targeted because they hate seeing a father who is competent and who knows what he's doing. Other toys that are very successful, blocks. Now, the Lego blocks, they are small and they are considered kind of dangerous at 2 and 3 years old. They will tell you it's appropriate at 4. But with supervision, children of 2 to 3 years old, they can enjoy the Legos, and they won't be able to click them necessarily, and they will need your help to unclick them. But with supervision, there's no risk of swallowing. And really what you find is this whole risk of swallowing is something that companies are very worried about. But if you're a present parent, you'll see that your children know not to swallow at 2 years old, at 3 years old. They are absolutely understanding that swallowing is for food and toys are a different thing. So they will have a pass, they will have a fad around 2 years old or before, where they are swallowing inappropriate things, and it won't take long for you to correct the behavior and no, that's not good, remove this from their mouth. And at 2 years old, they should probably be fine, or if you have done this, they should be fine to be supervised while handling smaller toys. The Lego, you can just build houses with them. You'll have to do most of the work at 2 year old, and then 3 year old, 4 year old, they will gain independence and they should be capable of building a house to their taste on a Lego platform. And if you're any afraid of the swallowing risks, just take the big blocks. The mega blocks are just as good. And children will love to build towers, kick them down. Ah, my tower has been destroyed. They love this cycle of create and destroy, create and destroy. And that's fine. That's fine. There is an age, the 2 to 3 year old age is very centered around destruction. They will love the part where they destroy the Lego rather than the part where they create. And then they'll get into creation. To start getting the children to use their hands and prepare them for school eventually, the drawings, very good, very good. You can just print infinite pages of those. They are all over the internet, colorable kids drawing. Give them a little house, give them a little animal. And at first they will scribble. And my philosophy with drawings is I don't guide much drawing. I let them, and at first they will be just scribbling nonsense stuff, and that's okay. Let them scribble and display it on the fridge like it's their art product, and eventually they will discover, oh, I can do a better drawing if I color the inside of this shape and this. So you don't have to do much guiding here other than, okay, choose your sheet, and they will spend 10 minutes, 30 minutes drawing on that sheet. If the child is accompanied by an older child, the older child's presence will be extremely beneficial to the younger child, because they will learn faster because they will see a model of what they have to do. And if your children are not separated, if they're separated by like 2-3 years, they will be close enough that one activity can be done by both. And the younger one can follow the older one's ways of doing. Green Fez says, what type of reading will JF encourage in a few years? Tolkien / Enid Blyton? I don't know Blyton, but I certainly recommend Tolkien. I was a big fan of Tolkien throughout my young adult life. I have read a lot of it. I have read also Forgotten Realms, Dungeon and Dragon type of literature. I've been enjoying that. It's been formative of my youth. Ryan says, Jeff, I'm a single 40-year-old man, 200K small house paid off, 60K truck paid off, 1.1 million in BTC, no other assets, live off 3% of BTC portfolio annually, reasonable retirement plan for a 40-year-old. Oh, bro, you're done. You're done. Work if you enjoy it. Work if you enjoy it. You're perfectly fine. You have enough money and enough stability financially. You will be fine. You don't even need as much as you do. If you're careful with your Bitcoin and you're kind of smart in terms of selling them at the peak and rebuying at the bottom, or if you just want to hold them as Bitcoin, that's also fine. You are set. Now, keep a job if you like it, if it keeps your cognition active. Concentrate on your family life. Concentrate on, do I have a wife? Do I need to charm a woman? Inseminate. You don't even need to work. At 1.1 million in reserve, and your life is set with your house bed, your truck bed, you have enough. There's no way you're going to improve your happiness in retirement with more work. Okay, so you are successful. Just enjoy, bro, enjoy. And if you want to donate some of these Bitcoins, there's an address in the description below. Sour Note says, exactly, my 2-year-old constantly imitates the 4-year-old, much to the 4-year-old's chagrin. Absolutely. And this is something you'll have to manage, multi-kids set up. The dependent smaller children will be stepping a little bit on the heels of the older child. And you don't, it's natural. You want to let some of this happen, the learning, the kind of horizontal caring that happens, let it happen. But also understand that your older child is getting deprived of some intimacy and some time with themselves. And there's all sorts of ways you can manage this. First, you can impose rules. When you see that they're starting to annoy each other, when you see that the young child will be all over the other child and wanting to play whatever the other child plays, you can say, hey, let's leave some space here. We're going to share this toy. You're going to play with this toy. You're going to play with another toy in another place. And let's get together then and exchange the toys. But sometimes the older children will be suffering from kind of a... I mean, I know about it because I've been the older boy in my family. And it's like we end up caring a lot for the youth. We end up caring a lot for our little brothers and sisters. And you just don't want... 95% of it is good. You want to let it go. But 5% of it is kind of a... It's an inhibition for the growth of the individual, the older one. You want to create space for them. And you can do also specific activities where one of the child is barred from attending. So homeschooling is one example where my children are distant enough in age that the homeschooling that I do with one child, the other child has to go play elsewhere and he has to leave us study what we're studying. Another crucial toy, so simple, so cheap, crucial toy for these age range, 2 to 4 year old, the classic plastic kitchen, absolutely great to start role playing. because, okay, with the crazy farts, with the Lego blocks, you got the constructive mind, thinking creative, thinking, what can I do from little pieces? What can I build from nothing? The kitchen set is an idea. The children will spend their days over it. They will start playing, acting like they're cooking, acting like they're adding ketchup to their recipes. They will develop scenarios. If you have many children, they will play, I'm the chef, you're the customer, you go on the table, I will serve you the plastic pineapple. And there's so many occasions to fake play, to begin playing roles, and this develops the social mind incredibly well. The mind to say, I occupy a place in the world. I am the chef. My role is to make the pineapple ketchup recipe for my little brother. He is the customer. Now, of course, these things won't be said explicitly, but they are all implicit to children play, and they are all important. They will all develop just naturally as you let them interact with this little piece of plastic. It is absolutely incredible. Crayons are perfect to start developing the writing potential of your children. They will not write letters with them. It will start with drawing, but their hands will develop, their fine motor skill will develop to stop at the right place so that you color only the inside of shapes. The crayons are just perfect for this. You will need them alongside empty white paper for creativity, and then pre-printed contour drawings for, you know, respecting shapes and starting to structure that creative mind. Crockpot Broccoli says, my kids have an epic mud kitchen. Well, see, Crockpot Broccoli, you are named correctly. You are a fan of broccoli cuisine, and you are training your children to broccoli cuisine. Now, you speak of mud. Children love, they love a pile of mud. And we have many festivals this summer in the area where I live, where it's so simple. They make a pile of sand, and the children, you'll see 30 children converging to this pile of sand, shovel, plastic shovels, trucks, that's all they need. They will dig this mound of mud. There will be no mound left at the end. And children will play the king of the mud, and they will stand at the top of it, and they will exchange toys, they will fill their trucks, they will transport sand. Just so simple. A pile of mud, if you can have one, or if you can have a sandbox, all of this is good. New Guy Prime says, heavy nostalgia with all this kid talk. I'm all verklempt. I don't know what verklempt means, but I think I know what you mean. Plapidus says, Jeff, what would be your analysis about the development of an only child versus one with siblings? This is very important. In my view, the natural development of children strongly benefits from being in a multi-children family. There is a strong benefit to it, a strong benefit to it. And I'm not saying if you have an only child, abandon him or it's not worth it. There's just, no, it's not dramatic. A only child can exist and can be educated well. But you can clearly see the differences between children that come from large families and children that are in single child family. So the child that comes from a single child family, and especially if that child is not put in much social circumstances, maybe they don't have many cousins, maybe they're being homeschooled by their parents, they will come to be extremely polite, extremely adult behavior children, to an extent more than the collectively raised children. And it might give you the illusion that only children is better. But I don't think it's better. I think they have something missing. And I think they got overtrained by a single individual. And they haven't learned to interact with contradictory signaling, with the conflicts. Conflict management is something they will have less. Now, they will be extremely polite, and in many ways, they will be able to avoid, as adults, they will be able to avoid conflictual setups because they're not used to them. And they, anyways, they've always had just their parent, and their parent was always on their side. So it's a different kind of raising, and it leads to different results. Children that are collectively raised will be a little more wild-looking, wild-behaving. But in my view, it's part of the normal drive of children. In my view, if you don't have a little bit of this, you're missing something in terms of your outlook on life, in terms of your risk-taking capabilities. So children who are from a collective background will have more capacity to manage uncertainty and anarchy and manage noise. And those are skills. Those are skills. Managing noise is something that we never talk about in parenting strategy. Because people, they think that parenting is to protect in a bubble. And it's kind of that to an extent. I mean, you don't want to throw your children to the crocodiles. But if there is some degree of quasi-crocodile structures in the world, you would want your children to be able to face them. You would want to be, them to be able to face them in a way that's not dangerous for them. But social interactions with multiple children in the home is one of the solutions to expose the children to, hey, you know, the world out there, there is conflict. You want your plastic shovel, but your brother also wants it. And these are very key management skills that are going to be lacking if you have a child who has been always raised by an overloving mother, for example, always protective, never in conflict. Well, what does this child face when he's 18 years old? He's facing a wild world with fucking bitches out there trying to fuck him. And he's going to lack equipment to handle this. And he's going to be very respectful and polite in the process of getting fucked in the ass. But sometimes that politeness is a little too much and it's a little too self-deprecating. Borup sends $10. He says, donating to the JF Homeschool Academy of Gifted Youngsters. I would love to give community homeschool math class. Because I have been... When I was in the U.S. and I was between jobs, one of the things I did is I offered advanced geometry classes to extremely gifted children. So there were children whose parents were contacting me and they were saying, look, my child is going insane. School is too easy. They hate school. They want to burn the school down. Is there anything you can do about it? And I developed this special program where I would go to a home for 1 hour and I would teach to a 8 to 11, it was meant for 8 to 11 years old children. And the goal was to teach them university level Euclidean geometry. And Euclidean geometry is sweet. It is the perfect mind-building tool. It is what Einstein was exposed to in his youth, much earlier than anyone of his age in his generation. And so I was like, if you want to build a little Einstein, if you want to give them a tool that is mind-building, let me do a geometry class for them. And I would spend 1 hour in the kitchen with an 8 to 11-year-old, either boy or girl, and in the presence of the parents, and sometimes in very noisy families, you know. I was entering those homes. I was paid like $30 for 1 hour. I was entering those homes, and it's like, oh, there's a 7-year-old yelling. There's a 5-year-old running around, just throwing things. And it's like, wow, okay, we're gonna teach Euclidean geometry to this little girl, and they were learning it. They were loving it. Because Euclidean geometry with compass and straight edge, without measure, without calculators, without numbers, per bisecting, like teaching an 8-year-old child to bisect a line with just a compass, that is beautiful. To teach them to measure the tan, to measure the tan not in numbers, not on your calculator, but measure the tangent by drawing a fucking circle around the triangle and making the cone, building the cone. That was mind-blowing, the results. The kids loved it. They were also becoming, they were more receptive to school after, because those children had the issue that schools are fucking retarded these days. And they were more welcoming of, okay, you know, I'm going to school because there's a meaning outside of it. I'm going to school, it sucks, but there's this framework in which I can aim for better. I can dream better. That is what Euclidean geometry will do at 8 years old, let me tell you. Now, this is not the subject of today. We're talking about 2-3 years old. Another thing that you can buy, although it's not yet fully age appropriate, it's a very good start. The alphabet wall stickers with images. So O, there's an owl. W, there's a wolf. X, there's a xylophone. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. To have these things sticked on the wall in your playroom is just, it's hours and hours of fun and learning. The kids won't stop. I have had them for a whole year on my wall. The kids are still using it in novel ways. So it started, of course, they don't know the alphabet. So it started with, well, first you have the animals. So at 2 years old or 3 years old, you can aim for a vocabulary of 50 words to more, starting at 50 words around 2-3, and then growing it to 300, 500. You will be helped by those animals. They won't know the alphabet aspect of it, but the lion is a lion, and they can learn it. Pointing to the animals. That's how it starts. And then once you get into school years at 5 years old officially, but I recommend starting it at 4, in the space between 4 and 5 years old, you can start teaching the alphabet and numbers. And it's going to be super helpful to have them on the wall, because as the kids write there for their first time, 7, 3, you can point on the wall and you can say, oh, look, the tree is like this. And so he's gonna just follow what's on the wall. Here's a R, here's a T, here's an M. So you started teaching them words with the meaning of the labels. And you can use books too. Just dig through a book, and sometimes you can read the story. I'm not a big story reader, because I think story reading is too passive of a teaching device. Like people who will read to their kids for 10, 30 minutes, I don't think it's very good. I get it that the kids get to learn intonation and sentence structure. That is good. But there are many other things you can do with a book, and some of them is exploring the images with them. What's that? It's a window. Well, what's that? It's a door. What's that? It's a monkey. It's a tree. It's an ant. And they build vocabulary like this. It doesn't even stop there. Those are such good investments. Even once my child had learned all of the letters, to write them, to understand them, and to be able to say that's Q, that's R, that's B. children will start at times. If you give them the idea, or if they see the idea on YouTube or something, the idea is out there of starting to mimic the shape of the numbers and the letters with their body. And now it becomes a whole game. Now it's like, oh, Papa, I want to do V. Oh, Papa, I want to do X. I want to do A. And they will contortion in insane ways. Like, try to do a U with your whole body. Let me tell you, it's a challenge. But this gives all sorts of skills. So children will learn that there are constraints in nature, that they can adjust their body to fit those constraints. You know, making a T is easy, but try to make an S with your old body. You have to kneel, and then you have to think about, okay, the S is shaped like this. Kids will just not stop. They will do this for hours. And it's like for something that costs 20, 30 bucks, you're going to be just hours of sitting there and seeing them learn for themselves. Absolutely beautiful. So in terms of let's look at the milestones for verbal development, because that's an important aspect in these years. Now, I will say, understand that there are children that have a motor-first development pattern, and there are children that have a verbal-first development pattern. And in my view, it's part of the sex distinction. At least in my experience, in my family, the girls have been developing verbal earlier, and the boys have been developing motor earlier. And keep in mind, these milestones, it really doesn't matter if you're half by month. Your child will not become a verbal just because he learned verbalism a little later, okay? So I am advocating for a broad and tolerant interpretation of these milestones. Because the fact is, I believe that the modern child is over-verbalized. I am absolutely convinced that never before in the history of civilization have we obsessed so hard with early verbal development, and in a way, way too early. As I see my male children develop, what I see is an engineering mind first. And it's a mechanisms of thing and spatial recognition first mind. You know, I will tell you, my boy has been able to handle joysticks and virtual spaces 2 years before my girl. 2 years in advance. So the girl has learned quicker language and quicker vocabulary building and pronouns coming in and structure of sentences. But there was a time where she was mastering all these language things, but she still couldn't understand the computer mouse or browsing through a joystick-like structure on her tablet. And the boy caught this, and he wasn't even speaking. So it's understand that there are different kinds of mind, and the engineering mind is a beautiful mind. It's a little bit the mind that I have, which is talk a little less. Now, I know it might seem contradictory because my job is to talk here, but in general, in my everyday life, I talk a little less and I do a little more. I'm more of a doer, and I'm more of a man who understands the structures out there, the bridges, the science, the IDs, the code. Cringe Panda says, yeah, I was bilingual by 3. Oh yeah, bilingual in which language? She says, in Steiner schools, they don't even start teaching reading and writing until age 6. Yeah, and that is fine. In the case of my children, they have mastered alphabet at 4-year-old. I don't care. I didn't care about pushing them to do this, but their instinct led them to be interested in this early. So I encouraged it. I allowed it, but I didn't try to cause it. And you don't need to have an advanced alphabetic understanding before the school age. It's okay to start kindergarten and have your first contact with the alphabet. But if you're with motivated children who have the capacity, you can teach that at 4-year-old. So vocabulary of 50 words, pronunciation is often unclear. That's what you get at the limit just before they reach to 2 years old. Now, it could be a little lower than this, and it's fine. Ask for common foods by name, cookies, sausage, milk, juice. Makes animal sounds, such as moo. Starting to combine words, such as more milk. I want more. I want help. I want to eat. And begin to use pronouns. So, I want to, or thank you. They will use these sentences entering into their 2-year-old mark. Between 2 to 3 years old, they will start understanding concepts like in, behind, on, onto. They will know about pronouns like you, me, her. The third person pronoun typically is the last to come. It starts with I and you. And then eventually the third person pronoun comes. New Guy Prime says pronouns are a trap. Well, if you send your children to the public school, yes, they will absolutely use pronouns as a political teaching tool. Uses question inflection. So you will start to see the interrogation where they will pronounce the sentence differently if they are asking the question rather than making a declaration or affirmation. And the beginning of the use of plurals, socks, shoes, that will start between 2 to 3 years old. And what you should aim for, roughly, and you know, identifies color, that is one that can show much earlier. It depends. Do you engage a lot with your children about color? They can learn color names and point to them at 2, 3. If you're less talking about color, but you're talking more about politeness, and you're insisting on thank you, and you're insisting on things like please, then you're going to develop more on the social side of verbalism and less on the descriptive side of verbalism. It's all fine. Every recipe works. At the end of it, they will know all the words. Sean Stedman says, Papa, I was wondering if the freedom to watch degenerate shows helps liberate the young mind. I remember watching Adult Swim at young age, and this was before it was leftist propaganda. Feels free. You know, this is why I'm so much for liberty. It's I don't know. I don't know if I'm becoming the same adult that I am if I don't have these subversive, authority-challenging experiments of my teenage years. Yes, you know, we were hanging out on computer networks with adults. Sometimes we were visiting these BBSs on computers, our parents weren't looking, and we were connecting to these adult websites or equivalent of websites back then, which was bulletin board systems. And we're not talking for the 2, 3, or 4-year-old mark here, but when you become 12 to 16, there will be some degree of authority challenging behavior, which should be tolerated. There should be a space for it. There should be a way for teenagers to make their own path in life. And it's not because you engage with degeneracy that you are degenerate. See, there's a way in which, let's say the drug world. So you're a teenager reaching 17, 18, you're starting to hang on the streets. There's a way you can see the drug world and look at it anthropologically. There's also a way in which you can fall into it because you're too close to it. So there's a sweet spot where it's okay. It's okay to be exposed to some of the archness of the world when you're a teenager or young adult. Not all of it will be good. And you might come out of these things with addictions and lost years of your life. But in the end, I hesitate very hard to completely completely overprotect young adults and late age teenagers. Because in the end, this will be out there. There is a point at which you will not be able to overprotect your growing adult children. And on that day, they will, if they have not developed the tool to reject this for themselves by their own morals, I'm afraid that some overprotected children, they jump into these worlds too quick, too harsh, in a way that they're not salvageable after. So I do feel that some degree of tolerance to even bad ideas must be tolerated in adult age and in the late teen years. Not talking about young children here. Young children do need to be protected simply because they don't have any of the mental tools to self-regulate. But ideally, you raise your children in a way that they will have the mental tools to self-regulate. That, to me, is the ideal parenting style. Finally, last big recommendation. As your child is completing his 2 to 3 to 4 year old, at 4 year old, they start, even if it's not obligatory, because it becomes obligatory at 5 years old to do the kindergarten curriculum. But at 4 year old, they are capable of handling the kindergarten curriculum. So you can absolutely get started. My favorite book for the curriculum of school is The Complete Canadian Curriculum, Grade K, Enriched Edition. That's if you're a Canadian. If you are in the US, there's an equivalent that is non-Canadian, The Comprehensive Curriculum of Basic Skills. Very thick book. Here you have the kindergarten grade, K, math readiness, reading, writing, colors, shapes, and sizes. It's a thick book like this. There's infinite activities for your children. You can go page by page through the whole book. Your children is going to know everything in relation to the kindergarten grade. And so those books are very good for homeschoolers. Both the U.S. and Canadian version, they're very similar. Magister Temple says, since when does Circle K publish the curriculum? I've seen, I think these curriculums have been edited and updated for the last 15 years or 20 years or so. So those are curriculum that have a big history, and they keep getting better year after year. You'll have everything in this, addition, subtraction. If you go for the enriched edition, you'll have addition, subtraction, alphabet, combination of numbers, growing the numbers above 10, reading clocks, English curriculum, arts curriculum, science basics, trees, biology, stuff like this. The two big portions of the book are English and mathematics. Absolutely great. A great curriculum. And a four-year-old can get through the K curriculum before they're 5. Although it's really only after they're 5 that it's obligatory in Canada. You will need to stand by your child. And my philosophy with it, although there's various modes to do it, my philosophy is my child, in a given part of the day, decides, I want to do schooling, Papa. So I sit at a small table with them. We open the page. And I read the exercise for them. So, okay, here what you have to do is count the number of eggs in the nest And then you have to add the number of eggs in this other nest and then calculate the sum. And children will be super happy. They will feel very accomplished once they understand the tasks and they're like, okay, I can do that. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2. Okay, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So I add to 5, so we get 5. Simple as this. And it's impressive how much you give them a pencil in their hand and they will start writing. There's no magic moment in which it's painful and, here, let's learn to write lines. No, because they've already practiced with drawing. You hand them a pencil and you say, look, there's the letter A here. And you reproduce it here. And maybe the first examples in the book, they have dotted lines. They will follow the dotted lines. And their very first attempt sometimes at writing the letter A will be just a beautiful A. And then as you go through hundreds of these pages, they will have written hundreds of each of the letter. And you know, at first, they don't necessarily understand what the letter are. So you say, okay, now we need to write an E. Well, let's look at some other place in the book where we can find an E. Or let's look on the wall. There's the E labels. That's how we do an E. And children will just reproduce these things and they will eventually, after they've done 5 or 10 of them in different situations, they will just know this is the letter E. It's beautiful how easy that is. It's insane how easy that is. Sadi says, not homeschooling is child abuse. I wish we thought like this, everyone. But clearly society has been taken, unfortunately, the other direction. Homeschooling is better. There's many keys to homeschooling. First, there is self-motivation and self-scheduling. But the problem of a child in public school is they get told, you go there. You go in that class. Now it's time to open your math book. You open your MacBook. And all of it is crushing the self-initiation capabilities of children. Now, is it dramatic? Our society needs sheep. It needs people who will follow the rules. And in a way, it's okay that there's a portion of the population that ends up being trained like that. But there is a key thing that is never trained in public school. There is a key capacity, and it's the capacity for self-motivation and self-scheduling. Now, this capacity is, on the one hand, very easy to train, but on the other hand, if you don't create the scenarios and the situations for it to appear naturally, your child will completely lack it. And I wonder when I see the obesity and incel and depression crises of the males between 18 and 30, I wonder how much of this have we caused? How much of the despair of the modern world have we caused? Because we forgot that our ancestors, they were waking up and we had to draw the milk from the cows and we had to plant the carrots in the spring. And we had all sorts of things that the child could say, hey, I'd like to help on the cows today. I'd like to help on the pigs today. I'd like to do this today. I wonder how much of this we've lost through the public schooling strategy. John Drake says, they don't teach anything about how economics really work either. The sheep might escape if they did. Oh, yeah. You know, there's one economy class typically in high school. And you really don't learn in this. You really don't learn how the world works for real in that class. I had the massive luck to have a super talented high school economics teacher. Insane guy. I mean, I don't even know how he was surviving in the Quebec system. But this guy, oh, bro, First, he made us invest on the stock market, and I won the contest. I bet on a diamond company that went from, it was crazy, it went from 5 cents to $1.50. And it's like I transformed my fictional $30 into something like $6,000. But this economics professor was one of the best educators I've encountered in my life. Other than François-Joseph Lapointe at the university level, this guy was probably the best at the high school level. And we get into the economics class, and he says, I want all of your stuff in the back. I don't want you to have access to anything. No carrying, no books, no noting, no pencil, no scissors. You got nothing. And then he drops. It was emotionally like very shocking. He drops 5 pairs of scissors at the middle of the class. And he drops a pile of paper. And he says, we are 30 people in this class. There's 5 scissors. And you're starting the industry of circle production. You are cutting circles from paper with these 5 scissors. There's 30 of you. There's way too many for the number of scissors we have. You organize it, whatever you want. I want a team that forms to be the most productive with their 1 scissor that they gather. And I want you to organize the workflow in teams such that you produce 200 of these paper circles in the most efficient way. That was good practical economics, because there was all sorts of conflicts emerging. There were resource conflicts. He started selling a 6th scissor pair. He was throwing at us all sorts of surprises as they would come in the market. And we were like, at first, it's insane that we were maybe 15, 16 year old children. And we looked at each other like, what the fuck is happening? What the fuck is this? 5 scissors. And there had to be a leader that rose and that took 4 or 5 people and said, hey, let's get together. I know how we can do this. There were problems to solve. The circle had to be respecting certain standards. They had to be drawn in a certain way. And it was like, here's your problem. Here's the wild market, creating all sorts of surprising events that challenge you. And in the end, the team that wins is the one that can produce 200 of those. New Guy Prime says, schools can't even contemplate such a course today. Yeah, you do this today, it's like, the class is going to be very hard to motivate, but it was magical the way he let leadership appear. He was very clear. I'm not giving any more instruction. And he was just sitting there. And I swear it took 5 minutes for it took 5 minutes for students to say, all right, well, we have to get started. Here, this is going to be our team. I'm taking you. And he let all of it happen magically. In front of his eyes. And I will never forget this learning experience. I would say, as a parent, do the same thing. Do the same thing that my economics teacher did. Just take a bag of popcorn and enjoy.